Hello there, and welcome. Today is Thursday, July 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president talks about his meeting with Vladimir Putin.
I think we got along very well, and I think that's a good thing.
Amid a firestorm of controversy at home, though, President Trump heads to Paris.
This visit is going to be a security nightmare.
A trillion-ton iceberg snaps off the West Antarctic ice shelf. Also ahead, a study finds there are four specific types of Facebook users. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, amid the firestorm here in the U.S. over the Russia probe, President Trump is now on his way to Paris, who he, in the past, has disparaged as an unsafe city because of terrorist attacks. He will be there for counterterrorism talks with President Emmanuel Macron and to mark the 100th anniversary of U.S. troops entering World War I. Trump a year ago described Paris as a so out of control, so dangerous place, and more recently suggested that Islamic State attacks in Paris had diminished it as a world-class destination. Joining me now for more on the visit is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, what else is on the agenda?
The start of his visit to Paris will be very much about remembering American airmen in particular who served in France during the First World War. He will be going to the American Cemetery just outside of Paris, and he'll also be going and laying a wreath at a memorial to American airmen and other soldiers who fought in France in the First World War. Don't forget that the reason for French President Emmanuel Macron inviting President Trump to the Bastille Day commemoration is that it's exactly 100 years ago since the U.S. joined World War I, came in and fought alongside French and British and Commonwealth troops in that war. It was very important for the French, in particular, that America joined the war when it did. It really did, both in 1917 and 1980, stop the German march on Paris. It really did save the capital. So that's really going to be the early focus. It's going to be, if you like, a way of remembering that the Franco-American relationship is very deep. It goes back many centuries, but also, you know, not forgetting that it's always been a sort of a tetchy relationship, but it's still there. And that is what Emmanuel Macron is hoping that he will do, that if you play on these historical relationships, you play on these very deep ties, then that could well win over President Trump, may win his confidence, and that could, in a way, influence U.S. policy, particularly in the areas where the French and the Americans just do not see eye to eye.
What was the reaction when folks there heard that your president had invited the president of the United States there?
It was very mixed. Let's just spool back a couple of weeks when this came out, and it was just after a major report from Pew in the United States, where they went around the world and found out, you know, what people in each country thought about President Trump. And it was discovered that about 14% of French people trusted President Trump to do the right thing. So this really happened within a day of that coming out. And now it would seem that about 59% of French people think it's kind of okay to have President Trump coming here. They feel that, yes, America did send soldiers over here to help them, not just in World War One, but also in World War Two, and that it's just really for Bastille Day, and that's kind of okay. That having been said, on the other side, there are demonstrations planned, there are protests. Protesters are going to try and set up what's been known as a Trump-free zone in parts of Paris.
Did you say a Trump-free zone?
Yes, it is what they're calling a no-Trump zone. And what they are basing that on is, about a year ago, one of the American networks, Fox News, was talking about Paris having no-go zone. So it's sort of a bit of a play on words there. So they're going to be setting up whole areas, this organization, of what they call no-Trump zone, because they just don't want anything to do with this visit. Don't be mistaken. This visit is going to be a security nightmare for anyone involved. And let's just look at the numbers. We're talking about 11,000 police and soldiers are going to be on the street during the time that President Trump and his wife is here. We're going to have metro stations closed down. There's going to literally be a 10-mile radius around the Place de la Concorde, which is in the center of Paris. It's going to be closed off. It's going to virtually be in lockdown. And, of course, on Thursday evening, Donald Trump will be with Emmanuel Macron, the French president. They're going to dinner in the Eiffel Tower. So the Eiffel Tower is going to be closed off. The security is going to be enormous. It's really going to be tough luck for anyone who's in Paris at that time, who's come for that trip of a lifetime to see the French capital, because they're not going to be able to see anything. They're not going to be able to get up the Eiffel Tower. So it's really, if you like, it's going to take over the whole of Paris for 24 hours. And again, the main point that Emmanuel Macron is going to try and get across is that you have to engage with Donald Trump. They do not want to isolate him. They just want to kind of bring him in, try and change his mind, and just hoping that their common ground, which is on matters such as security, particularly when it comes to Syria, when it comes to fighting Islamic-inspired terrorism, that's what's going to keep the relationship going and keep some sort of liaison between the two countries.
All right. We appreciate your insights. Thanks so much. That's Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Well, President Donald Trump, meanwhile, says the White House is functioning perfectly despite media accounts that it is in chaos from his eldest son's disclosure of how he met last year with a supposed Russian government lawyer who offered incriminating information about Hillary Clinton during the presidential campaign. Now, before his departure for France, the president gave an interview Wednesday morning to the Christian Broadcast Network founder, Pat Robertson. It's the first media outlet apart from Fox News to be granted an interview with Trump in the past 2 months. Pat Robertson asked about Trump's meeting at the G20 summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
I think we had an excellent meeting. One thing we did is we have a ceasefire in a major part of Syria where there was tremendous bedlam and tremendous killing.
He also asserted to Robertson that Putin would have preferred Hillary Clinton in the White House.
If Hillary had won, our military would be decimated. Mm-hmm. Our energy would be much more expensive. That's what Putin doesn't like about me. And that's why I say, why would he want me? Because from day one, I wanted a strong military. He doesn't want to see that.
Earlier, he renewed his claim that questions about links between his presidential campaign and Russia amount to, quote, the greatest witch hunt in political history. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. U.S. city, states, and businesses are vowing to still measure greenhouse gas emissions. A Washington shop sells $3 falafels to feed refugees. 6 police killed in central Kenya, where drought is fueling violence. And the Kremlin's Sputnik radio to broadcast alternative news in Washington. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Trump's choice to lead the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Christopher Wray, assured lawmakers on Wednesday that the agency would continue to be free of political influence as it conducts business, including a special prosecutor's probe into Russia's meddling in the 2016 presidential election.
I believe to my core that there's only one right way to do this job, and that is with strict independence, by the book, playing it straight, faithful to the Constitution, faithful to our laws, and faithful to the best practices of the institution. Without fear, without favoritism, and certainly without regard to any partisan political influence.
Wray is a defense attorney and former Justice Department official. He faced questions during his confirmation hearing from members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, including inquiries about whether he can work independently from the White House. The hearing was held as Trump faces months of multiple investigations into allegations that his campaign colluded with Russian officials to help him win the White House, and that he possibly obstructed justice by firing former FBI Director James Comey. Well, scientists say a massive iceberg has broken away from the continent of Antarctica. The iceberg measures 5,800 square kilometers and weighs over 1 trillion tons, making it one of the biggest on record. Joining me now is climate scientist at St. Thomas University in the U.S. state of Minnesota, Dr. John Abraham. Thank you for being with us. So how significant is this development?
It may be really significant, and it may not be. We just don't know. So what happened was a portion of an ice shelf calved, which means it broke off. That in and of itself happens. Now, it doesn't often happen to a portion that's this big, but calving happens. What's interesting is two of its neighbors, the Larsen A and Larsen B ice shelves, have calved in the past and then rapidly disintegrated. In addition, when an ice shelf calves, oftentimes the rest of the ice starts to flow faster to the ocean. So what scientists are going to be watching is whether this calving event, which just happened, leads to faster ice loss or signs that the ice shelf would collapse. And that's really an open question.
And if it does, how big of a problem is it and why?
Boy, if the Larsen C ice shelf collapses, it's a really big problem because we don't expect it to, and this would be a sign that there's going to be more to come. And there are more delicate ice shelves in the southern hemisphere, in Antarctica. And if Larsen C is going to go, those others are going to go as well. Now, why do we care? Because when ice on land, ice sheets on land melt and go into the ocean, that leads to sea level rise. And coastal communities are very at risk of that. One of the most at-risk places in the United States is Miami. Right now, scientists expect sea level will rise by a little over 3 feet by the year 2100. That may not sound like much, but that's 150 million people that will be displaced worldwide. But that 3 feet is predicated on not having huge ice sheet collapse. So if Larsen C would collapse, that would suggest that 3 feet is an underestimate of what's going to happen. So it'd be bad news. Scientists are watching for signs that there's going to be a collapse. We don't observe them yet, but that doesn't mean they won't happen. So the verdict is still out, but if it happens, it's going to make a lot of news, and it's going to be really bad news.
And we've been hearing a lot, speaking of news, about the planet warming potentially a lot faster than scientists had previously thought. You know, I mean, we've been hearing all kinds of things, including, you know, that the Earth could be uninhabitable sooner than anybody thought. What's your take on that?
Well, the news that the Earth is warming faster than we thought is correct. I was part of an international group that just published a paper in the journal called Science Advances this spring, and our measurements show the Earth is warming faster than we thought. And that's bad news because it means two things. It means, first, it's going to be harder to slow it down, and two, it means that the consequences are going to happen sooner. Now, what are the consequences? Well, I already mentioned sea level rise. That's one. More extreme weather is a big concern. Something called ocean acidification is also a concern. So there's all these consequences, and as a result, they're going to cost human lives and human dollars. Big cost to society and the economies. So the Earth is warming faster than we thought. It means that we have less time to take action to stop it. Now, we still can. We can still do things today that will slow down and stop climate change. And in fact, we have the technology to do that. We just haven't had the political will to do that. We have a hopeful message that humans can take action, but a sobering message that we have less time.
All right, Dr. John Abraham, climate scientist at St. John University in Minnesota. Thanks so much. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
We
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, a new film premiering on the streaming service Netflix, To the Bone, takes a poignant and sometimes humorous look at the issue of eating disorders. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the film reflects some of the real-life struggles of its director and one of its stars.
Lily Collins plays Ellen, or Ellie, as she prefers to be called. Ellie comes from a Los Angeles family where her father is never home, her stepmother is distant, and her real mother is a lesbian with a bipolar disorder who moves to Arizona to be with her girlfriend. Ellie has an eating disorder but gets kicked out of her fourth ED rehab. She finally agrees to an unconventional inpatient facility run by Dr. Beckham, played by Keanu Reeves. It's there that Ellie meets Luke, a British dancer whose career was cut short by an injury and who is the lone male patient in her unit.
Cigarette for dinner. That's not going to get you points.
Not in the mood.
Okay.
And who in hell made you house dead, mother? You walk around here like you've got it all figured out. Well, if you're so fixed and special, why don't you go back to New Jersey or London or wherever the fuck you're from?
I am going back, as soon as my BMI is closer to my age. But right now, I'd rather try and help people than mope about feeling sorry for myself.
You have no idea how I'm feeling.
To the Bone is based in part on director Marty Noxon's own 10-year struggle with eating disorders. Lily Collins, who also struggled with an eating disorder earlier in her life, says that the film was never intended to glamorize anorexia, but to give it an honest treatment.
Nor Marty or I, having gone through the disorder ourselves, nor anyone else in the cast and crew would ever actively pursue making a film that glamorized, fetishized, or encouraged a disease that is so negative. Those were our intentions.
Alex Sharp, who plays Luke, and Collins both told the Associated Press the film deals with a serious subject, but it's not intended to be morose.
It is a dark, it's serious topic. I think serious is a better word than dark, but it's also got a lot of humor to it. So I think we're trying to hone in on that.
Yeah, no, I think it's actually amazing that we're even having a conversation about it.
Totally.
That's the important thing, is that we're sitting here discussing a subject matter that people have steered clear of for a long time.
To the Bone has generated some controversy, with some critics and social media users voicing concerns that the film glamorizes eating disorders. Lily Collins denies that criticism and says that all art pushes some boundaries, including this film.
If you're putting something out into the world for yourself, for a positive reason, for the right intentions, then that's all you can do, and people are going to take from it what they will. And hopefully people take away from this film that, you know, asking for help is never a weakness, and it's a strength, and that you're never alone in your struggles.
Alex Sharp agrees that artists have faced controversy in the past, but that's not an excuse for avoiding controversial subjects like eating disorders.
I mean, even as far back as like Michelangelo and his painting, commissioned work, but slipping in things that weren't in favor of people that were commissioning it, and like making a statement that's personal controversy. I think that sort of comes with starting conversations, as you were saying, about the history of starting a new conversation on something that's important always causes waves.
To the Bone also stars Kerry Preston as Ellie's stepmother Susan, Lily Taylor as her biological mother Judy, and Liana Liberato as her half-sister Kelly. The film streams on Netflix beginning July 14th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Well, turning now to what's happening in social media, we're joined by VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. Hey, Andrew, what's happening?
Yesterday, we talked about how President Trump was
going to be sued for trying to block people on Twitter, and people are still talking about the emails that his son released on Twitter. So a lot of politics going on social media. And that's no exception today. We're getting some insight from author Mark Leibovich, who wrote a 2012 book, This Town, about the inner workings of D.C., and he's now written an article for the New York Times Magazine called This Town Burns Down, about the unconventional politics of the Trump years. And they talk a bit about social media in that article. And they actually have a quote from President Trump, who vows to Leibovich that he'll stay on social media despite these missteps and the lawsuit against him. The quote is, "It's my voice. They want to take away my voice. They're not going to take away my social media." So the president very adamant that he will stay on social media despite all of these missteps and everything that's going on.
Okay. Anything else?
Yes. So there's a, moving away from politics.
Okay.
A study about how people use Facebook and specifically what the characteristics of specific Facebook users are.
Mm.
Now, the study comes from Brigham Young University in Utah, and it's called I Heart Facebook, or I Heart FB, a Q methodology analysis of why people like Facebook. They asked a bunch of subjects to respond to questions about their Facebook use, how they felt using Facebook, what specific types of activities they engaged in, and what they shared on Facebook. From that information, they were able to determine four types of Facebook users. So the first one is relationship builders. These are people that build and sustain relationships with friends and families. They catch up with family that might live far away or friends they've lost touch with over the years. They stay connected through Facebook. So those are the relationship builders.
Okay.
Then you have the window shoppers, the people who don't post anything. They just browse content and they click on other people's content, but they don't put anything up of their own.
Right.
Then you have the town criers, who are the people that use Facebook to advocate for a specific position or try to organize people.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the selfies, which I'm sure you can imagine what the selfies people are. They're the people who post content to gain attention and get everyone to look at them. These researchers from Utah say these are the four types of people that there are on Facebook that they've distilled it down to.
Interesting.
Yeah, looking across the board, I think that's a pretty good representation.
Yeah, I mean, I can see myself in that. I'm not going to say which one, but, you know.
Nor will I, but I can definitely, I read one of them and I said, that's definitely me for sure.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
All right. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, a young singer and actress is releasing a new single. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to describe this multi-talented performer.
An actress who says her first love is music, and she's working on her first studio album right now. Her name is Hailee Steinfeld. And you may recall Hailee from True Grit, the remake with Jeff Bridges from 2013. She was only 13 at that time and received an Oscar nomination for her role as Maddie in the film, and also got a Golden Globe nomination for her acting abilities. And a few years later, she decided, well, you know, I've always loved music, so I want to pursue music. And she released a single at that time, which is called Love Myself. She says the song's about girl power, girl empowerment, true to the title, Love Myself. And then she followed that up with another hit in 2016 called Starving, which was produced by and featured EDM producer Zedd and did very well for her. And now she's back with a brand new single, and we're going to check it out right now. It's called Most Girls.
Some girls feel best in the tiny dresses. Some girls, nothing but sweatpants, looking like a princess. Some girls kiss new lips every single night. They're staying out late because they just celebrate in life.
So does she see herself more as an actress or as a singer?
Well, you know, honestly speaking, right now she says a singer. Although she's in the upcoming Pitch Perfect 3 film that's going to be opening soon, she had a role in Pitch Perfect 2, and it was so popular they brought her back for Pitch Perfect 3. But she is now saying music is her first love, music is her true passion. She hasn't released a studio album yet. She's had an EP, which she put out about a year ago, called Haze, which was her nickname growing up. And but she's in the studio working on a full studio album, which is where we find the song we heard today, Most Girls, which is a great song, up-tempo, dance music, happy music, and again, more female self-empowerment. That's the message that Hailee is right now pursuing with all her younger fans talking to the younger girls. You know, it's kind of stand up for yourselves. And so, I love her music. I love what she's doing. But I think she's got a bright acting future as well. She's been, as I mentioned, nominated for an Oscar and a Golden Globe at the age of 13. She's tremendously talented. Oh, yeah. And she was in a film last year that got critical raves called The Edge of 17. So, I mean, she's got a great future ahead of her in showbiz, shall we say, whether it be music or acting.
Yeah, and you never know. Musicals are kind of coming back a bit in movies, so maybe she can combine both.
And she's only 20.
Wow.
Don't you hate it? 20 years old.
All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
Most girls work hard, go far. We are unstoppable. Most girls are fighting back every day. No two are the same. I wanna be like
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music.
Wake up, dance this music.
Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned over the recent violations of the ceasefire in the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, which have resulted in multiple reported civilian and military casualties, including a young child. In a statement issued July 6th, the State Department called on both sides to cease military action and return to the negotiation table. In their statement released July 5th, the co-chairs of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Minsk Group called upon the parties to cease military action as violence only begets further violence and accomplishes nothing. The co-chairs called upon the sides to return to the negotiation table in good faith. In an earlier June 19th statement, the co-chairs underscored that such negotiations are the only way to bring a lasting peace to the people of the region, who expect and deserve progress toward settlement of the conflict. Stefan Dujarric, the United Nations spokesman for the Secretary General, stated on July 6th that the UN also shares the concerns of the OSCE Minsk Group co-chairs over recent ceasefire regime violations. We, the UN, call upon the sides to refrain from any military action and strongly urge them to take immediate steps to de-escalate tensions and prevent further violence. An early return to the negotiation table in good faith is the only way to resolve this long-standing and dangerous conflict, Mr. Dujarric said. For its part, the United States continues to engage intensely with the sides. The long-standing policy of the United States, shared by the Minsk Group co-chairs, is that a just settlement must be based on international law, which includes the Helsinki Final Act, in particular, the principles of the non-use of force or threat of force, territorial integrity, and equal rights and self-determination of peoples.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.